Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, the New York Island, the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 364, recorded on Sunday, April 11th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week from New York is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Bill.
And on the line from here in Massachusetts is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
This week on the show, we're talking about the industrialization of natural rubber use and its consequences for the people in the global South. So, Kelly, I'll go to you first. Could you talk a little bit, just as background to set the table here, for the ancient history of natural rubber before the Columbian Exchange and the modern era?
Absolutely. So it is probably unsurprising to any scholar of history that the Aztec, Maya, and Olmec people of Mesoamerica had uses for rubber and knew how to work with it hundreds and hundreds of years before the Europeans sort of got a hold of it and then redid the process of learning how to work with it. And so records indicate that societies in Mesoamerica were using latex by 1600 BC, which is a full 3,000 years before Mr. Goodyear vulcanized and stabilized rubber in 1839. The two uses cited most frequently were sandals and rubber balls for games. These ball games were a really central piece of the societies of Central America. And so not only were they able to use the rubber, which they were able to tap from trees, but they also mixed it with morning glory vines, which made the latex less brittle. And so the ratio of latex in morning glory vines depended on whether it was more important for the rubber to be durable or bouncy. So they would mix the rubber in these vines up differently for sandals and balls, which they wanted to bounce more. And it's really unsurprising that they made these gains, given that we know that these early societies of Mesoamerica were committed to scientific inquiry and found not only this natural resource of natural rubber, but then figured out how to mix it with these vines to use it for different purposes, from ball games to rubber sandals.
So after the Columbian Exchange begins, if you want to call it that, following the arrival of Christopher Columbus's voyage into the New World and everything that followed from that, rubber experimentation in Europe occurred from that point onward at the end of the 1400s until the end of the 18th century, when early industrial capitalism started trying seriously to put rubber into use as an industrial product component. Research in the second half of the 1700s had come up with better knowledge of rubber's properties, advantages, and disadvantages, as well as gradually some ideas on how to use it as more than a novelty. According to one source that I read, which was from a book, The Fate of the Forest, Developers, Destroyers, and Defenders of the Amazon by Susanna Hecht, a rubber factory making ladies' garters began production in France in 1803, which would have been, if not the earliest, one of the earliest sort of industrial uses of rubber. If you look at the Wikipedia article for natural rubber and then look in the history sections, you can find a summary of how rubber has been used in the textile industry. Quote, rubber produced as a fiber, sometimes called elastic, had significant value to the textile industry because of its excellent elongation and recovery properties. For these purposes, manufactured rubber fiber was made as either an extruded round fiber or rectangular fibers cut into strips from extruded film. Because of its low dye acceptance, feel, and appearance, the rubber fiber was either covered by yarn or another fiber directly woven with other yarns into the fabric. Rubber yarns were used in foundation garments, While rubber is still used in textile manufacturing, its low tenacity limits its use in lightweight garments because latex lacks resistance to oxidizing agents and is damaged by aging, sunlight, oil, and perspiration. Now, eventually, this natural rubber was, of course, supplanted in the industry by synthetic rubbers, such as spandex, because they are more durable and stronger than natural rubber-based fiber. And we'll talk a little bit more in just a second about synthetic rubber, but this episode is going to be about the natural rubber and its uses in the industrial revolutions, so we'll focus on that for today. Now, of course, as noted in that passage, rubber can be very temperamental in both the harvesting process, which Nate is definitely going to get into somewhat later, and the industrial production process. There's a lot of room for error or permanent spoilage resulting from ambient conditions either in the jungle or in a hot, grimy factory. So as Kelly noted just a few minutes ago, vulcanization was a critical piece of the puzzle for the industrial use of natural rubber. To make that more stable and more usable in industrial processes and for various products. From 1834 to 1839, Charles Goodyear, a northeastern U.S. experimental chemist and engineer, was experimenting with chemical mixture ideas to harden and strengthen the finicky natural rubber for industrial purposes. One of the biggest challenges was rubber heating up and then melting. So in 1839, he was shocked to discover that it was actually possible to use sufficient heat to harden rubber rather than melting it, which he patented and named vulcanization, although originally, according to Britannica's entry on this, he called it fireproof gum. Generally, the process also involves sulfur, even to this day, and some molecular bond interactions that I didn't really understand well enough because I did not get a good grade in 11th grade chem class, so I can't explain that on air. Maybe one of you will explain it at some point as we go, but it doesn't really matter as long as you understand the gist of what was being accomplished. Goodyear had fine-tuned his new process, by 1844 to support real production and began licensing the patents for use in Europe. Apparently he became, I didn't find a whole lot on this, but he, I guess, became a major producer of industrial rubber in the United States for a while, based out of Massachusetts. One thing to note here is that the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, which was founded in 1898, is named in his honor, but isn't actually connected with him. I found that out a few months ago from a different podcast, but I didn't know that until then. Now, Goodyear had some problems defending his patents in Britain, but he had an interesting quote that he wrote in his personal papers, which I found fascinating as a perspective from one of these 19th century inventor guys. Quote, in reflecting upon the past as relates to these branches of industry, this writer is not disposed to repine and say that he has planted and others have gathered the fruits. The advantages of a career in life should not be estimated exclusively by the standard of dollars and cents, as is too often done. Man has just cause for regret when he sows and no one reaps. And that was published in a 1939 centennial book in Boston honoring his work. Now, interestingly, Goodyear died in 1860, just over 20 years after his invention, and just before the massive rise of rubber usage over the course of the Second Industrial Revolution after the American Civil War, with all the horrors that inflicted on the people of the Amazon and then Africa and Asia, as we're about to talk about in just a few minutes. I found that interesting, though, that because he died in 1860, you know, he sort of launched this process, but didn't really see it take off to the enormous extent that it was about to, because the point when he happened to pass away kind of marks a approximate turning point in the first and second industrial revolutions in the United States and to some extent in Europe. Now, the statistics reflect the changes resulting from the vulcanization process for the industry. The rubber extraction boom that followed clearly represents or reflects at least a ravenously growing demand in the global north. In 1855, as Kelly's going to talk about in a few minutes, over 2,100 tons of rubber was exported from the Amazon, but that figure reached 10,000 tons by 1879. Those statistics are from Barbara Weinstein's book, The Amazon Rubber Boom, 1850 to 1920. And plantation production, which Kelly will talk about, began in the mid-1870s to try to keep up with demand that could not be met by naturally occurring and often widely dispersed wild sources in the jungle. Now, before we get into that, though, I just wanted to talk about at least briefly, how this changed the industrial economies of the world. So common uses of natural rubber in the pre-World War II era included things like wire insulation, door and window profiles, hoses, industrial belts, gaskets, matting, flooring, vibration dampeners, rubber tires, which includes either solid or pneumatic tires for both bikes and vehicles, kitchen gloves and insulation gloves, boots, toy balloons, rubber bands, pencil erasers, the aforementioned textile uses, rain gear. There's another brand name involved in that. Macintosh, as in Macintosh raincoats, was an early pioneer in rubber processing, although it actually took Goodyear's vulcanization to make it work as a material rather than his initial idea of just a waterproofing treatment to put on raincoats. Rubber's also used in certain kinds of masks, in scuba gear, in athletic balls, which, of course, traces back to the ancient world. I also didn't realize how old scuba gear was, actually, and it seems like rubber was an important component in making that work as well. Now, let's talk very briefly about synthetic rubber, just so we have a framework to understand kind of where the natural rubber industry is at this point. So synthetic rubber was a relatively small share of rubber in use each year until World War II, when the disruption of global rubber production and trade, especially in Southeast Asia, and the urgent rubber demands for war material compelled the United States to rapidly ramp up production of petroleum-based artificial rubber by over 100 times to some 820,000 tons a year by 1945. This was achieved apparently through direct U.S. government production during the war, and then they conveniently sold off all those new factories to the private sector after the war, according to the Rubber Manufacturers Association. Today, about 70% of global rubber is synthetic, which is obviously the bulk of it, but then I looked in to see, well, how much actually is that? And it turns out that natural rubber is still in quite large use by volume. By 2008, despite the dominance of synthetic rubber, all the natural rubber still being harvested worldwide each year exceeded 10 million metric tons per year, led by Thailand, Indonesia, and the Philippines, according to the entry on development of the natural rubber industry from Britannica. So that gives us some context of sort of the arc of this industry, and now we need to obviously talk about the horrifying costs that imposed on people from other parts of the world who had to supply this natural rubber. So Kelly, I'll start with you chronologically here. Obviously, it makes sense that there would be the first sort of boom in this would take place in the Amazon, given that Latin America in general had been the source of rubber originally in the ancient world. But talk to us a little bit about what happened there before we moved production to other parts of the world.
Absolutely. So before production moved to other parts of the world, the Amazon was really the place to get rubber. It grew naturally in the trees, in the rainforest. And so the Amazon had the first rubber boom, which took place from 1879 to 1912. And it happened in the Amazon base of Brazil and Bolivia and also parts of Peru. The Amazon rainforest touches all of those countries. And to give you an idea of the size of this boom, in 1855, 2,100 tons of rubber were extracted. And by 1879, just about 25 years later, 10,000 tons of rubber were extracted. So that's almost five times as much in a 25-year span, which is quite sensational. The boom resulted in a large expansion of European colonization, which what used to just be a rainforest was now an area with these very valuable rubber trees. So as a result, it was colonized. More immigrant workers were attracted. Wealth was generated, and as a result, there were some pretty serious cultural and social transformations, which are still present today in this region of Brazil. Of course, that came with a severe cost, like all of these things. It will be unsurprising to you to learn that havoc was wreaked on the indigenous societies of the area. And it's estimated that in some areas, as much as 90% of the indigenous population was wiped out. And just to provide an example of that, one of the more egregious atrocities in the region happened to the Putumayo people. And this was in Peru, where Julio Cesar Arana had established himself as a rubber baron in Peru's Amazon and primarily used the indigenous people for the very physical work of harvesting labor. And not only did he enslave the indigenous people of the region, but he also imported people from the Caribbean and enslaved them. And just to read a quote here, Arana's rise to a position of power, money, and influence was aided by the geographical conditions of Peru. To travel from Iquitos to Lima, it was necessary to go around what is now Panama by boat, a journey that would take weeks. It took less time to reach the coast of Portugal, Madeira, than Lima. The Amazon was, in many ways, an autonomous region where borders were loose and political control from the central government was almost non-existent. Furthermore, the government needed the entrepreneurs to protect the border against foreign invasions. This allowed people like Julio Cesar Arana to act with complete impunity. The local judiciary was in place to protect the interests of local businesses. People from outside the region were not welcome. These enslaved people, both from the indigenous people from Peru, as well as people brought from the Caribbean, they were enslaved and they were treated like enslaved people are, not given enough to eat. This is dangerous physical work. No thought was given to their safety or protection. And they were just at the mercy of this rubber baron. And I think what's interesting here is not only was this just what was happening in the day, it is not a surprise that colonial powers allowed this to happen, but also that this sort of geographic feature of these communities being really isolated in this very dangerous Amazon rainforest, and that geographical isolation just allowing these systems of enslavement to thrive without the watchful eye of pretty much anyone on the global stage. And so, like I said, it's pretty grim, the statistics and the stories about the Amazon at this time, where as much as 90% of the indigenous population was wiped out. The booming rubber industry meant a lot of wealth for some people, the barons, the people at the top in particular. Manaus, which is the capital of the Brazilian state of Amazonia, had a per capita income of twice as much as Brazil's coffee producing regions. There was a theater built that still stands today. Electric trams were brought to the city, and it was considered the world capital of the sale of diamonds, just to give you an idea of sort of the opulence and wealth that was created for the few in charge of these systems and companies. Another notable aspect of the rubber boom at this time was that as workers needed more and more rubber, they advanced into territories that were not theirs, particularly between the border of Brazil and Bolivia. There was a lot of tension, which required quite a bit of diplomatic intervention from time to time. One of the significant geographic challenges was just how to navigate this area, how to get things in and out of the area. There are waterways, of course, throughout the Amazon, but they're hard to navigate, especially if you're trying to do things at sort of the scale of industry and trying to export essentially 10,000 tons of rubber from this region. So a railway was built. And this railway came to be known as Devil's Railroad on account of having caused the death of around 6,000 workers. In one legend, it said that there's one dead worker for each railroad tie in the rails. And this was a railroad constructed by a United States corporation. And again, just goes to show the complete disregard for life in this area, that this was built in such sort of a catastrophic and dangerous way. The railroad was finished in 1912, just as the rubber industry began waning. So it was a little bit of a miss. One of the more bizarre aspects of the rubber industry that I'd like to mention is the town of Fordlandia, which was built by Henry Ford in 1928, a few decades after the end of the rubber boom in the Amazon, but Ford was really seeking his own source of rubber for tires, mainly for his motor vehicles, so that he didn't have to deal with the British rubber monopoly that existed at the time and was producing rubber throughout Southeast Asia. Ford signed a deal for 2.5 million acres of land in Brazil and an exemption of all export taxes in return for 9% of the profits, 7% which would go to the Brazilian government and 2% which would go to the local municipal government. He signed this deal with the country of Brazil with the idea that he could just sort of, you know, drop his people in the middle of the Amazon, hire local labor, and have this very efficient rubber plantation. Of course, that is not quite how it went. One of the main challenges, again, was just getting there. And they, of course, insisted of bringing in a water tower from Michigan, furniture from Michigan, all of these sort of impractical things that they needed to get into the town. Also, the Ford managers who worked there just knew nothing of agriculture in the Amazon. And of course, many succumbed to malaria and yellow fever. Again, I just imagine them sort of dropping off these like people from Detroit in the middle of the Amazon and saying, like, get rubber. And it is way more complicated than that.
Sorry, I just want to chime in. There's a really good book by Greg Grandin, a really cool historian about Fordlandia. I think I read that in college and definitely very eye opening.
Yeah. And in typical Ford fashion, he wasn't going to adopt to the ways of Brazil. Instead, he decided to dictate the rules of the community. So there was no alcohol, no women, no football, all sorts of rules. He even had people go door to door to inspect people's houses and make sure there was none of this like contraband in the house. He further insisted on serving American food, like hamburgers and whatnot, in the cafeteria. And in 1930, there was a revolt, which was called the Breaking Pans Revolt, over all the American food that was served in the cafeteria. And eventually, they agreed to start serving more local food. But just goes to show you sort of how, I don't even know, stubborn is not the right word, but how sort of unprepared the Ford company was to operate a rubber plant in the Amazon. And so with all of these project failures, and as Bill said, the development of synthetic rubber, the project was pretty much a total failure, and Henry Ford's son sold the land back to the Brazilian government at a loss of $20 million. So that just sort of gives you a sampling of the you could talk about any one of these things for hours, and people like Nate said have written very interesting books on it. But just to give you a sample, this is where rubber was at this time. This is where it was native to. People in the region knew how to use rubber. And so this huge rubber boom brought serious exploitation of the local indigenous people. It also brought the colonization and the building and everything that goes along with that. And in very bizarre twists, it also brought Henry Ford in his attempt to create this American colony, essentially, in the middle of the Amazon to no avail.
So we talked earlier about how the demand was rising sharply during the Second Industrial Revolution, heading into the 1870s. And by the mid-1870s, they were working on trying to cultivate some sort of plantation-style production in the Amazon to support the level of natural rubber that was being desired by industry in the United States and Europe at the time, but it still simply was not enough. Now, they continued their cultivation efforts, as Kelly's just explained, over the course of the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and into the early 20th century, but to supplement this production, and before we get to talking about production in Southeast Asia, there was a significant attempt to get a lot of rubber very quickly, very cheaply, out of tropical areas of Africa. And for that, we're going to turn now to Nate to talk about the book King Leopold's Ghost and the Horrors of the Belgian Congo.
Yeah, so I just recently read King Leopold's Ghost, a very famous sort of a popular history that I think really helped bring this issue to attention of the sort of general public of the absolute horror that was the Congo Free State under King Leopold of Belgium. And, you know, there's people debate about the death toll and stuff. In this book, it pegs it around 10 million. So we're talking about severe mass murder, exploitation, people being taken as hostages, people being whipped to death, just some of the most horrific stuff you can ever imagine. Of course, everything with the hands being chopped off. There was a rule basically that if you fired a cartridge, if part of the force publique, the military police there, if they fired a cartridge, they needed to get a hand to bring back to prove that they had killed someone. You weren't allowed to hunt, apparently, only hunting humans. So, but we should talk about how this all started off. In 1890, the bicycle craze was taking off. The Dunlop Company started making tires that, you know, of course, you don't really want a ride that has no support or whatever, that would just be too bumpy. So the inflatable rubber tire really did change things up. And you talked a little about Bill before, Charles McIntosh, the waterproof rubber. So that was sort of the background to all of this. And King Leopold was initially trying to get in on the colonialism game through ivory, because I guess ivory back at the time was a little bit like plastic today, in that it could be molded into a lot of different shapes and stuff, and it was quite valuable. So that was sort of the initial idea, but he went extremely in debt because of his investment in the Congo. He's also trying to invest all over the place, including in Egypt with the Suez Canal, I think, at one point, also in the open door policy in China. So he's all over the place. He was basically like a CEO obsessed with all these different numbers and stuff coming in. And so it turns out that in Congo, there's a lot of wild rubber. And the point was, there was going to be a situation where there would be the price would go down at a certain point because of various plantations that were being developed in Latin America and Asia. But that takes a couple decades for rubber to mature and be able to be tapped sustainably, or at least to get a large production of it. So basically, there were two decades where Congo had a wild rubber boom, and this was the time where they got tremendously wealthy. Like, it's an insane amount of wealth, and like all of it went to building insane palaces in Belgium that still exist today, giant archways, greenhouses with all sorts of various plants from the Congo that I guess you can still tour today. So that might be interesting just to see how everything got spent here. But I guess we should focus in some of the details here. When Kelly was talking about the various railway situation that was going on there, definitely reminded me, because at a certain point, they had to bring rubber had to be carried by porters. It could be sent down the river, the Congo River, but at Stanley Pool, as it was called, there had to be basically people hauling it on their heads, especially enslaved Black Africans, to the coast so they could be shipped out away. But eventually a railroad was produced, but they brought in a lot of Chinese laborers. And that was the idea. So, but then hundreds of them died. There were cemeteries basically pocketing the entire route there. And of course, there would be guards basically keeping them in the work camps. And then every morning, crowds of angry laborers would lay dead bodies at the feet of their European supervisors, the bodies of their comrades who had died during the night. And there was a saying that each railroad tie cost one African life, and each telegraph pole one European life. So that was sort of the situation there that I thought was related with the railroad. But I think we should make the point that, yeah, it became tremendously profitable. So the King set up several sort of investment companies that could potentially, he would get a cut of that, and then they would bring the rubber back to Europe. So one of the companies, the Anglo-Belgian India Rubber and Exploration Company, or ABIR, they spent 1.35 francs per kilo to harvest rubber in the Congo and then ship it to the company's headquarters in Antwerp, where it sold for prices that reached 10 francs per kilo, a profit of more than 700%. And by 1898, the price of ABIR stock was nearly 30 times what it had been 6 years earlier. So we're seeing a tremendous boom, similar to what we talked about with the cotton boom about a century beforehand. And overall, by 1890 to 1904, total rubber earnings increased by 96 times over. So pretty significant, I would say. And the I think the big issue that we're looking at here is rubber is not capital intensive to harvest. However, it is extremely labor intensive because you have to climb up a lot of the time these very tall trees. People would fall and break their backs or be killed. You have to climb higher and higher to tap the rarer vines. And if you were to fully cut a vine instead of just tapping it, it would result in death also. But then the quotas that were required by the Belgian colonialists were such that oftentimes you would have no choice but to cut the rubber plants. So, you know, sort of a catch-22 there. The laborers would have to spread it on their bodies, I guess, basically, in order for it to coagulate a little bit or something so they could basically store it. And, you know, even the Forest Public people recognize that this was not a great situation. It's like, the native does not like making rubber. He must be compelled to do it, said Louis Chutlin from Forest Public. Sometimes as many as 24 days per month were spent in the forest sleeping in cages for protection against leopards. So basically, the Forest Public would show up at a village. Everyone would flee immediately because they knew what was going to happen. The Forest Public would start destroying the village, oftentimes raising villages to plant more rubber, or they would just destroy all the food and chickens, try to capture the women, and then use those as hostages to compel further labor. And at some places, the quotas were as many as 3 to 4 kilos a fortnight. And I think they were estimated at one point, due to the metal disc system to track laborers, there were about 47,000 laborers at this one time. But as we all know, about 10 million died. And then, of course, the payment was often little trinkets, cloths, beads, and most importantly, a knife. In order to actually tap the rubber. So, you know, we can go more, you know, all the details about this. There's a lot going on in this book, including history of some of the people who very bravely expose the rubber trade and the extreme horrors that were going on there. Whether it was people like Edmund Morel, who's basically like a trade official, but noticed that we're getting back a ton of rubber from the Congo, but we're only sending guns and there's no balance of trade here. And he recognized, okay, this is obviously slave labor. So yeah, that's that situation. And then there's also a lot of other really interesting characters like Roger Casement, who I saw people were posting about on Twitter the other day. And his diary was a great source of the history of what was going on. He traveled there extensively. And then he later died in jail because people found his diary and recorded his he was open homosexual and decided that you know, he wasn't going to hide it necessarily, but also if someone found the diary, then that would be a real bad situation. Also, people like George Washington Williams, who was an early black historian, a Civil War veteran, who traveled throughout the Congo, exposed a lot of the issues that were going on there in a letter to the to King Leopold. Unfortunately, he died on his way back to America. So just there's a lot of really interesting stuff in this book and a lot of different ways that you can sort of look at all of this. I do want to mention one other thing, that there is a good documentary recently that came out on HBO Max called Exterminate All the Brutes, by Raoul Peck, who's made a bunch of different movies, some of which I've seen, about people like Patrice Lumumba, the young Karl Marx. He has a thing on the Rwandan genocide. So a really good filmmaker. And he connects a lot of these issues in a way that, you know, were not surprising to me or probably some of the listeners of this show, just because we've talked about stuff like the Herero and Nama genocide conducted by the Imperial German State in Southwest Africa. But it really goes into how the colonial exploitation of the global South paved the way for fascism in Germany. And then, of course, the continuing effects that we're seeing to this day. So I could talk maybe a little bit more, but we should probably maybe move on to talk about Asia a bit.
Yeah, there's also additional notes that we'll include in the episode notes PDF up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when we post this episode. So as you said earlier, Nate, during this period, it takes a while to get a rubber plantation to maturity if you are able to get it to succeed at all. And so this African natural rubber harvesting of wild rubber out in the jungle sort of was an interim step for the global industrial demand for rubber between the situation in the Amazon and what eventually came to dominate the global natural rubber production, which was Southeast Asia. And as I mentioned, even today, with those 10 million or so metric tons per year being harvested, although that was 2008 data, so you know who knows what it is now, the leading countries today, Thailand, Indonesia, and Philippines, if you look at the rest of the top 10 list, you know, it's a couple of African countries, but overwhelmingly, it's still Southeast Asian countries. So Kelly, I will go to you now to talk about how it was that rubber production ended up in Southeast Asia. There were obviously various attempts to bring it from the Amazon to other places, some of which were more or less successful than others.
Sure. And I'm going to start just by reading the Wikipedia bio about Henry Wickham. Sir Henry Alexander Wickham was a British explorer and plant thief. He was the first person to successfully export a large, viable shipment of Brazilian rubber seeds to the British Empire. He did so under false pretenses. The British had long planned to create rubber plantations in Southeast Asia, and using Wickham's batch, the resulting plantations brought about the end of the Amazon rubber boom. And so this is considered perhaps the greatest biospiracy in history. Sir Henry Alexander Wickham claims to have smuggled out 70,000 seeds. It was not technically illegal to smuggle out seeds, but obviously they didn't really want you to do that. And so the way that Wickham got these seeds out of Brazil was to claim that they were academic specimens, which were sort of supposed to be like dead, unviable animals and seeds and plants. But of course, they very much were viable. And So the seeds arrived to Kew Gardens in 1876. And of the 70,000 seeds he smuggled, 2,400 successfully germinated in the gardens. And this was enough to begin spreading rubber plants throughout the British Empire. And so this really changed the game, changed very much like the trajectory of history and the trajectory of the economy in South America and in Asia. And another important person in the sort of the making of the rubber industry in Southeast Asia, Henry Nicholas Ridley, who was the first scientific director of the botanical gardens in Singapore. And as the scientific director, he wasn't just interested in like pretty flowers or what we might think of in botanical gardens, but he was very invested in creating financially beneficial crops and plants in the region. And so he widely distributed these rubber seeds across the region and also developed a method for tapping the trees for rubber without injuring the tree. He was so passionate about rubber and all of its many industrial uses that he earned the nickname Mad Ridley, which I can only imagine him just getting very animated about rubber uses and rubber crops in order to earn that nickname. So he was really responsible for establishing the industry in the Malay Peninsula, where he resided for 20 years. And the area began to increase its production of rubber during that time. One Chinese landowner, Tan Che Yang, grew 40 acres successfully in the region, and that just sort of was the proof point that was needed. Once he, in 1898, successfully cultivated those 40 acres, more and more people in the region saw that there was money to be found here, and so began planting those rubber trees, essentially bringing an end to the rubber boom in the Amazon. And one of the reasons for that, that it signaled the end of the Amazon rubber boom, was just that these plantations were much more efficient than sort of looking for that natural rubber or navigating the difficulties of the Amazon rainforest. And so and also for the British Empire, you know, them being, these countries being part of the British Empire, also meant that it was just more efficient as far as taxes and finances and everything else were concerned to sort of have this homegrown rubber within the British Empire. And still today, if you Google Southeast Asia rubber production, there is still a lot of rubber production happening in this area. Again, just goes to show you sort of the change in course of history and of the environment as these 70,000 seeds were exported from Brazil.
Yeah, as I said earlier, this, you know, we went from a situation where there was no rubber production happening in Southeast Asia to overwhelmingly the natural rubber in the world coming from Southeast Asia, a situation which remains to present day. But you know, not to make a pun here, the seeds of the sort of downfall of the natural rubber industry, despite how much is still being produced today, happens because of this dependence on Southeast Asia as well. When we're talking about Indonesia, which was a Dutch colony at the time, when we're talking about Malaysia, which was British Malaya at the time, when we're talking about the Philippines, which was under the control of the Americans after 1898, we are talking about all these territories that fell very early to Japan after the attack in December 1941. Only Sri Lanka remained firmly in Allied control for the whole war, and that forced the Allies to come up with some alternative solution to keep up with their rubber demands. They had to put a lot of rubber tires on trucks for all of the trucks that were needed for the war effort. I saw one thing that said that the Soviets had tried to experiment as well with synthetic rubber. They did some petroleum experiments as well because they had control of the Baku oil fields and that sort of thing. But they also, I guess, tried to use dandelions in some way. Not really sure how that worked. That didn't really go very well, apparently. But as I said earlier, the Americans had the sort of major breakthrough with cheap petroleum-based synthetic rubber and then ramped up production very, very quickly just in that period from the end of 1941 to the middle of 1945. And at that point, the dominance was there. The production capacity was there for synthetic rubber to rapidly overtake natural rubber. And of course, as we said earlier, it's a stronger material anyway than natural rubber is. So we'll leave it there for today. As Kelly did say earlier, there are so many things in this that we've talked about today that you could spend hours talking about. And so we're just kind of giving the broad overview in hopes that people will go off and look up specific subpoints on that themselves. Again, we'll have the notes up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode goes live. Nate, I'll circle back to you for sort of closing summary thoughts first on all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I will just maybe repeat what I said before about the similarities between the cotton boom and the rubber boom, it kind of seems like, where you have these extremely lucrative commodities that are basically essential to the emerging, what we would now consider like modern life, civilization and everything, where almost couldn't imagine life without them now, like rubber or just the easy access of cloths and linens and things like that. But if you actually look into the history, a lot of this easy access is, of course, provided by massive degrees of exploitation in the Third World, especially, or Global South. So, I mean, this is something that we should always be looking at, whatever we're talking about, really, whether we're talking about like modern supply chains and things like that, where stuff is being produced, or also just looking back at the history of all sorts of different stuff. I mean, I was reading a book about the salt. There was I remember that book came out mid-2000s or something like that. Just started rereading again. But you can do this for pretty much any commodity. So I feel like it is important to sort of take a look at the history of a lot of these things. Not that I'm like some super eat local or whatever, even though you could always do more of that. But it's just sort of like, yeah, these are very important histories, especially when you see like the massive horror that something like the Congo Free State perpetrated.
Kelly, I'll go to you now for your sort of summary thoughts on this.
Yeah, similarly, just I've been thinking about how sort of ubiquitous rubber is to our lives, and yet how much history there is and how many themes we see repeating in history, from colonialism to enslavement of indigenous people to sort of theft of natural resources and some pretty serious environmental challenges. All in your little rubber eraser at the end of your pencil. So just important to step back and sort of realize how much history these things have that we take for granted each day.
All right. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for being on the episode this week.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
And Nate, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks, Bill.